You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
I'm Tony Heath.
And this is the Watchathon of Rassilon.
You always stare at me right after you say that, and it fills me with this immense dread. Just immense, terrifying dread. I just thought you should know that.
Cool. Play the theme song. Today, we're going to be talking about the second serial of the 24th season of Doctor Who, Paradise Towers, which consists of four episodes that aired from October 5th, 1987 to October 26th, 1987.
True facts!
And I want to give a special shout out to Bisexual Brigadier for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, thanks, Bisexual Brigadier.
You can check them out on Tumblr at bisexualbrigadier.tumblr.com. And joining us today, we have a brand new guest.
Ooh.
Yeah, we're introducing him real late in the game. It's Steve Conway.
Well, hello.
Welcome to the pod. We've talked about you so many times.
Well, yeah, and it's always kind of odd because I tend to listen to the podcast when I'm driving around and I'm just in the middle of some boring kind of commute or something, and I suddenly get a name check and I'm like, hey, wow. And it kind of almost makes me think, why are these really cool people talking about me?
That's how we feel about you.
Yeah, absolutely bonkers.
You've led a very interesting life, and we just sit in our living room and talk about Doctor Who.
Well, you know, I've watched Doctor Who since I was a little child, and you guys are making me see it through different eyes, which is something really, really special.
That is a question I ask all new guests. How much of Doctor Who have you seen? Have you experienced?
All of it, I would say, in that, like, I watched it in the old traditional manner first. So I grew up in Dublin in Ireland, and we were just kind of in the overspill area of the BBC terrestrial signal. So on Saturdays, you used to be tuned in. Now, I was born in 64, so from about 1969, so the last series of Patrick Troughton, I was starting to watch it. I was old enough to watch it. I have specific memories from things like The Mind Robber and The War Games. And then from the start of John Pertwee onwards, I was absolutely hooked. And I would never miss an episode on Saturdays. So I used to watch it all the time then. And of course, on the BBC, unlike in North America, there was no way to see the old episodes because they would get a repeat once the summer after they were first broadcast, if you were lucky, and then they would never be seen again. So I used to catch up via the Target novelizations, which were really fun. Waiting for a Target novelization to come out in those days was like waiting for a DVD to come out these days, or a special series box set.
I assume, did you watch when, I know they like re-aired some of some past ones when they did the Five Doctors special. Did you check those out when they aired? Was that like, oh, I get to see these again?
That's it. The first time I really remember them doing a significant old rerun was when Tom Baker quit. His last episode was broadcast, I think, around March 1981. And there was a 9-month gap before Peter Davison started airing. And in around November, December 1981, they did this thing called The Five Faces of Doctor Who.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah. And first of all, the first thing that they aired was Unearthly Child. And I was like, I was so excited. I dragged my mother into the living room and made her watch it, even though she was not into Doctor Who at all. But this was like, I'm seeing the first ever episode.
That's amazing.
And speaking of first ever episodes, I had a very interesting experience with this podcast, which you may find a little uncomfortable.
Oh, fun.
Oh, good.
I joined the listeners of this podcast from about episode 4 or 5.
Truly bonkers. Those episodes sound like shit.
Well, no, they were very good. maybe sort of Marco Polo-ish or thereabouts.
I just had like a huge memory of us recording it on the floor of our bedroom,
mm-hmm.
like next to the bed with one microphone between the two of us.
Yeah, very high tech.
I know there were a few times when you had audio incidents where things weren't quite the way you wanted them, but the content was brilliant, and that's the whole thing about good podcasts or good radio. If it's good content, people will listen and they'll keep coming back for it. But the first thing I did was I wanted to go back and listen to the old episodes, and I was able to get from episode 2 onwards, but for some reason I couldn't locate episode 1. So that was fine, and I stayed with you and, you know, got right through to maybe Stones of Blood or thereabouts, you know, episode 100. And then finally, episode 1 popped up on my feed and was available. So I went back and listened to it. And it's really interesting because at the very, very start, and this is the thing in media, you'll make throwaway comments because you're trying to be funny. And they're designed in such a way that someone will laugh for a moment and then move on and never think about it again. But you forget that the way people can re-listen to and re-watch things these days, those throwaway comments can come back to haunt you.
I'm so worried.
At the start of the very first episode of Watchathon Rassilon, you made this little throwaway comment and you said, this podcast is going to be a metaphor for our sex lives.
I truly don't remember saying that.
It sounds right.
Do you know what? I dare you to go back to your recording of the first episode, dig up that clip and insert it at this this particular moment.
Is this a metaphor for our sex life?
Yes.
Okay, good. As long as we're on the same page.
But the interesting thing is, for anybody listening then, that would have meant nothing because nobody knew anything about the podcast. But I had listened to 100 episodes of Watchathon when I heard you made that comment. So I knew lots of things.
No.
And I kind of thought, right, so Watchathon is a metaphor for their sex lives. So what do we know? So I've come up with 8 facts.
Oh, nice.
Eight is so many. Okay.
It's as many classic doctors as there is. So.
Well, look, you get a choice, actually.
Okay.
It's either going to be 7 facts and Joe doesn't get really cross with me, or it's going to be 8 facts and he does.
Oh, well, yeah, then I want 8.
I'm fine with 8. Hit me.
Again, anyone listening, what's either going to happen now is they will grudgingly accept what I tell them, or this bit is going to be edited out and you're going to be wondering why Joe and Tony don't talk to me for the rest of the podcast.
The shortest podcast ever follows.
Things we know about Joe and Tony's sex lives because of the podcast. Number 1, it happens about once every 3 weeks.
True.
Number 2, if you're willing to give them $15 via Patreon, they don't mind you watching.
Hey, please do that.
Number 3, mostly it's just the two of them, but from time to time, they like to have a friend join in, often someone who is at their wedding.
Today it's you.
Yeah.
Welcome to the orgy, pal.
No, the orgies are the ones that you do between doctors when you get about 8 or 10 people on and you all get drunk.
That's true.
Number 4. At the point in the proceedings where any normal couple would turn to each other and ask, how was it for you? You just get into a pointless fight about what time it is.
Pretty accurate.
Number 5. Tony can never, ever remember it. Her eyes just glaze over. She says, yeah, I'm sure it was great, but I'm struggling to remember anything that happened.
Whoa. He gave like a heads up for like me being cross, but just attacked you.
Number 6. There's obviously some kind of BDSM element, although I haven't fully grasped that. All I know is every now and again they start talking about the master, and it sometimes involves Tony having to do laundry afterwards. And I'm pretty sure as well that with the Sea Devils, I heard them say that the master was on the sub. Number 7. This one makes me kind of sad.
Aww.
After today, it's only ever going to happen 10 more times. That is unless you take up my suggestion and go for Blake 7. You get a whole 52 further episodes.
We're figuring that one out. We got to spice it up, you know?
And then number 8, which somehow I think will get lost in the edit. As we know, we have heard her say this many, many times. Tony gets really excited by really small things.
Ah! You know what? That's true.
Oh, God.
I can't be mad if you're talking, if you're just telling the truth, you know?
No use getting angry over facts.
Joe facts!
Let that be a lesson to you. Don't give hostages to fortune by making grandiose statements at the beginning of a podcast series. Someone will listen back and find you out.
See, I was worried that after that last one, we might have to prematurely end the podcast. But we're good. We're good.
Yeah.
God, we gotta actually do a podcast now? We gotta follow that up with actual content? Jeez.
We gotta follow that up with actual content. Are y'all ready to talk about Paradise Towers?
We are indeed.
Yeah.
Then let's do it. Let's dive into episode 1, which I have called, this is fairly obvious, but Red Kangs are best.
Red Kangs are best.
And I believe you have titles as well.
Yeah, my titles are so bad, they're going to make you look so good. Episode number 1, Kangs Ain't What They Used to Be.
Pretty good, pretty good. We both went for a Kangs angle, a Kangle, if you will.
I will not.
All right, fair enough. So, we begin with a yellow Kang. The only one we will see in this entire serial, because she's going to be dead soon, and she's the last one. To quickly describe what the Kangs are, they're just incredibly color-coordinated women, right?
They're just gangs of teenage girls. That's a Kang.
You got a yellow Kang, you got red Kangs, and you got blue Kangs.
And red Kangs are best.
Well, there's an argument to be made that blue Kangs are the best by the blue Kangs. you're team red Kang?
Sure, I don't know.
Yeah, I am too. What team Kang are you?
I would be yellow Kang.
Ah, nice. And going for the underdog.
Absolutely.
Well, spoilers, they're about to lose in a big, big way. but she's running around in this trashy corridor being chased by other Kangs that we can only hear, who eventually give up, and then something else comes for her and attacks her, and we don't see what it is. It's just a POV monster at this point. And then we cut to the doctor and Mel, who Mel is watching a video about Paradise Towers, and she really wants to go, specifically, she wants to go to the pool. And the doctor is less interested in this. He's like, that's not very adventurous. And I feel like that's the first time that the doctor has not wanted to go swimming. That was like a big thing with two, I feel like.
Well, he lost his pool, so...
Yeah. Did that happen in a previous serial, or is that just...
No, that happened.
Was that in the Fourth Doctor thing?
I don't remember what it was, but they had... I think it was a Fifth Doctor.
I thought it was Legopolis or something. Not Legopolis.
They had to, like, jettison a bunch of rooms at the TARDIS.
Yeah.
Oh, Castrovalva, which I try and forget because it was just a mess of a story.
But I guess that's a reference to it. I'm not sure.
Well, you were mad because you were like, we were watching it and you were like, you have a pool. And then he was like, yeah, I haven't had a pool since I had to
jettison it
that one time in that one episode. And you were like, oh, yeah.
One thing which I'll point out is that any story that begins with the companion getting dressed up to go to the beach or go to the seaside, or Sarah Jane Smith with her beach ball, or I'm going to go swimming, always, always ends badly.
I mean, honestly, every episode something bad happens, but specifically, swimming is a no-go. And
well, last time we had, like, somebody swimming on Doctor Who, we got Perry as a companion, so maybe it is best we avoid it.
So they land at Paradise Towers and it's completely trashed, covered in graffiti, and full of rats. There is a scene where the Doctor tips his hat and says hello to a metal pump. Mel says... No, Doctor. And he says, well, you never know. And that was improvised.
Really?
Yeah. That was a Sylvester McCoy original. The writer even said that on the making of. So it's not one of those things that, like, Tumblr likes to do, where it's like, every scene in every movie is improvised by the actors. That one is a legit improv. they're about to split up. The doctor's going to go look for Steph, and she's going to try to find the pool. And she's like, if something happens, we should meet up at the pool. And he's like, well, what could happen? And then they immediately get shot at by arrows, which when I was rewatching this to make notes and make GIFs, you can clearly see hole marks in the wall where the arrows are going to wind up.
Really?
Yeah, because I imagine, I guess they just did multiple takes of it, or maybe they even pop out of the hole. I'm not sure. But you can see where it's where they're going to be. It's like when you're watching a cartoon and something's colored slightly differently.
That one's drawn on an animation cell.
And then we meet my favorite character, Caretaker 345/12, subsection 3. My favorite Doctor Who character of all time.
Okay.
Yeah. He's got such an easy to remember name. He's very memorable. Caretaker 345/12, subsection 3.
Isn't he about to die?
Yeah, it's very tragic when Caretaker 345/12, subsection 3, dies. It's very sad. I'm not ever going to not fully say his name.
Oh, God. I'm glad he's about to die.
But then you are now going to say the full name of every other caretaker who gets referenced in the story, aren't you?
No.
That's the only one I see in your notes.
It is the only one I wrote in my notes. He reports into the chief caretaker about wall scrawlers, because that's the graffiti. That's one good thing. That's something I really liked in this serial, is there's a lot of good, like, dialogue and language.
Mm.
Like, it sets up its world really well, and, like, it feels lived in with all this kooky, interesting dialogue.
I like how much it feels like a game mm-hmm. that kids are playing.
It does, specifically with the stuff the Kangs say.
And then it ends up making sense, because it's like, oh yeah, when the Kangs came here, they were like all children. So they pretty much just grew up as like mobs of children.
That's it. And there were no real adults around, except for people who were an awful lot older. So they just associated with each other, and they had their kind of very genteel version of Lord of the Flies, I guess.
It's weird. There's like, it's all old people or young people and nobody really in between, because they say they all went off to war. But I like to imagine that it was like a Gog or Fritchum sort of situation where they just got rid of the useless third of their population.
Oh, no.
I mean, the one person who was in that group who stuck around is, we'll meet later, and he's somewhat useless. But then the Doctor and Mel meet the Red Kangs, who chant, Red Kangs, Red Kangs, Red Kangs are best. And Blue and Yellow Kangs are cowardly cutlets. We learn that the two main Red Kangs are named Ben Liner, who I find incredibly attractive, and Fire Escape.
Their names are amazing.
They are amazing.
This is such a good choice that someone made. Thank you. Thank you for making a character named Bin Liner. I love her.
She's only been in one other piece of media. She was in some horror comedy in the 80s. That's it. Doctor Who and some horror comedy. That's it. It's very sad because she's great. I love Bin Liner.
I love that we were watching this and Joe was talking about the one Kang that was very attractive. And I was like, they all look the same. Like, they all have, like, the same outfit and the same hair. And you were like...
She has a good face.
They have different faces. And then, oh.
Yeah.
Right.
Your face blindness. She looks like if you combined Garfunkel and Oates, both of them together. Kate Micucci and Ricky Lindholm.
I could see that person being attractive.
She is. It's Bin Liner.
And there was another one called No Exit, wasn't there?
Yes. I don't remember who she is. They also give a name to the Blue Kang in the novelization, I think, but not in the actual episode. I think it's like Water Fountain or something like that. But she doesn't get named in the actual serial, only in the novelization.
One would have to assume that they had proper names that their parents gave them, but for the purposes of the game, they wanted to adopt the names of objects that they saw around the towers.
And I think, like, I guess most of the names they pick are somewhat associated with their color. Like, a fire is red. A no exit sign would probably be red.
Bin Liner?
Bin Liner would usually be black.
Maybe it has, like, one of those, like, you know, like, you have the little strips you can pull out and tie it together?
Tab. Yeah. All right. Okay.
Sure. And a water fountain's blue. Because water's blue, right?
It doesn't seem like you really have enough data to be making this claim, but okay.
I'm going to put it on like a BuzzFeed article sort of thing. It's going to be my theory.
BuzzFeed, like you don't write articles for the dip.
I should do it on the dip. Good point.
You literally write theory articles for the dip.
Yeah, but I write good theory articles for the dip. bad theories. I want to save for lesser media.
Like BuzzFeed.
Like BuzzFeed. I'm starting a war right now between BuzzFeed and The Dip. The Dip, our best. Anyway, they talk about, they do a very intricate greeting with the doctor, Firescape. She throws her fist up and then grabs it and then lowers it down. Then she throws her other fist up, grabs it, lowers it down, then claps and then sticks her hands out and they sort of touch hands.
What is it that they call it?
How you do?
How you do.
And then the doctor does it back. He almost screws it up, which I kind of like. I feel like it was just Sylvester McCoy screwing it up, because he does the fist punch, pull down, fist punch, pull down, but he almost forgets to do the clap, because he just goes straight for the, like, touching her hands, and he, like, quickly claps and then touches her hand and then goes down. Then he does an extra little bit where he rolls his hat onto his hand and then rolls it back up onto his head.
There's a lot of hat-based action in this particular serial. He's forever doing things with his hat in it.
Yeah, before they even leave the TARDIS, he has his hat up on the center console in the TARDIS when it's going up and down. His hat's just on top
really?
Of it. Yeah.
I did not notice that. That's great.
He also does a lot of doffing of his hat to various people that he meets.
Very cordial.
I'm a big fan of the hat roll. I'm going to learn how to do that.
You should. The Red Kings really like the Doctor. They say he is of high fabtion and he is ice hot. But they don't like Mel.
Because Mel is wearing blue.
She is. She's wearing like a blue polka dotted thing. It looks very similar to her last outfit, just blue and polka dots instead. I think last time she had stripes and they were red. See, if she just kept that on.
Yeah, if she had that outfit on, this whole episode, this whole serial might have gone differently.
We see the blue Kang for the first time. She pulls a phone out and says that the last yellow Kang has been made unalive. And then we see that yellow Kang inside of the cleaner, which is just a big giant robot.
It looks so sweet. It looks like the world's sweetest robot.
It's gigantic and has like three terrifying arms.
I know.
And it carries around dead people in its like waste basket in the back.
Not everybody's perfect.
I just wonder, in its originally designed function as a cleaning robot, what is the giant screw for?
That's a good question. You know, tightening up nuts and bolts, I guess. Screws, I guess. That actually makes more sense. But it is really big. Maybe they just really big screws. It rarely uses that, too. It mostly just grabs them with the grabber hand. Also, it's very bad at stuffing people into its wastebasket because there's always a foot sticking out. Always.
I know. That's kind of one of those things that, you know, when someone makes a joke and then they keep making the same joke again and again and again. The first time you see it, you see that there's a particular view they do and you see the front of the robot. Then you see the side of it that goes as it goes by. And then you see the trailer and you see the foot sticking out of it. And you go, oh, my God, you know, there's a dead body in there. But after about the 10th time that they do that same shot, again and again and again, it's kind of, yeah, we know.
Now I'm just embarrassed for this robot. Get the whole thing in there.
I mean, maybe it's just not a lot of space in there. So you got to leave 1 foot out. Just one.
To be fair, that is sleeping rules. You got to have 1 foot out from underneath the covers for control.
Do you think they're sleeping?
Oh, maybe it's a similar reason.
All right. Then we cut back to the doctor, who's just full on dancing with the Red Kangs, having a good old time. And that's when he learns that there are old ones, caretakers, and an unmentioned group that they seem like they don't want to talk about.
I do like that they're like, there are old ones. And then later when you meet the old ones, they're like, we're Brezzies.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Rezzies.
It would be really rude if we were just called old ones.
And then they said that there's no visitors allowed in Paradise Towers. So they don't know how they got there. And the Doctor and Mel try to leave, but the Kangs tie them up. Then my favorite character, 345/1-2, subsection 3, is grabbed by one of the cleaners as he's talking to the chief caretaker over his little walkie-talkie. And he's basically like, I'm being attacked. And he's just like, I know, it's fine. And then he sort of blames it on the Red Kangs and tells the other caretakers to grab the Red Kangs. I don't think we've seen the chief caretaker at this point yet. We will later, but I think right now we haven't fully seen him. But he looks like Hitler.
Oh.
He looks Hitlerish.
Yeah, I had rewatched Paradise Towers there about 3 or 4 weeks ago, obviously knowing that this record was coming up. But I decided I would watch it again this evening, and I made my wife watch it with me. And her first thing when they did the reveal and showed his face was, why is he made up to look like Hitler?
That's like a thing that they do too, right? Where...
Oh yeah, they do like a little salute that's just, they put their fingers under their nose.
Just making a little Hitler mustache.
Yeah, they're basically doing like a Sieg Heil, but it's just a little finger under the nose thing.
It's not subtle.
It's not subtle, but it's fun. I know that there was a lot of criticism against the guy who plays the chief caretaker for overacting and being hammy. And to them, I say, boo, you're wrong.
What are you watching this show for?
It's goofy, sure, but it's fun. Have some fun, people. They specifically don't like spoilers, I guess, but later on when he becomes basically a zombie and he's like, there is no voice that's like theirs. They don't like that. But like, I thought that was very good. I felt like it was like he truly didn't know how to be in a human body. Like, it'd been so long for him.
He's very good at being bad at moving.
Christine brought this up during the live stream. The Edgar, the bug from Men in Black, when he's walking around in his Edgar suit. And he looks very uncomfortable the whole time. Anyway, back here at the beginning, the caretakers come to grab the Red Kings. The Red Kings all get away and Mel gets away. But they do get the doctor. They go away with him. Mel winds up breaking off from the Red Kings and winds up having tea and cookies with a couple of Rezzies, Tabby and Tilda.
Fantastic. Beautiful characters.
Two older ladies who are clearly cannibals.
I do have one thing that kind of slightly irks me in this scene, and that is the first time that she's there, they ask her in for tea and cake. They ask her if she wants another piece of cake, when clearly what she's eating is a cookie. Not a cake.
That's true. I didn't even think about that. That's a problem of like, oh, we have these props, but the script says something else. I imagine.
Just say the different thing on the day. You can do it. It's allowed.
Not allowed. But they're great. I love them. They're just very nice old ladies. But like, they clearly set up that they eat people.
They're doing the Hannibal thing.
Like, because like, they're about to let her in, and then the other one's like, oh no, there's big old bones on the table. Hold on a second. And then dumps them off, and they're like, come on in, come on in, come on in. And they keep saying things like, oh, you look delicious, that sort of thing.
You look cute enough to eat.
Yeah, I love that kind of stuff. This cereal is the first time in a long time, I feel like, where it actually kind of feels like a children's show. Like a family show, specifically. Mm. Specifically with like the Kings, you have a lot of like it is like they're playing a game, or the dialogue is very, I don't know, specific and almost childlike. And there, also when they get to the end, it's kind of like, let's all team up together, which feels like a moral from a children's show. But I actually kind of enjoyed that. I thought it was fun. They don't all have to be dark and gritty. And even still, there's cannibals in it, so. But the caretakers are taking the doctor somewhere, and as a rule, they give the doctor a walking break. Because they're like, after so many steps, you get a break, according to the book. And he's like, how many of you have walked? And they're like, I don't know, we're probably there.
Do you know, again, sometimes as you move forward in time, you can take things out of a serial that were never there in the first place. But when they ask him how many steps he's taken, he clearly looks at his wrist, which meant nothing in 1987. But now it means he's looking at his little, you know, Apple Watch or his Fitbit or his whatever to see how many steps he's taken.
That's fantastic.
I didn't even think about it. Yeah. It's like anytime there's like in like old sci-fi stuff when they have like something that's basically a cell phone, but it's like way before there were cell phones.
Yeah, or like one of my favorite ones was way back in the Tom Baker era, early Tom Baker as well, Planet of Evil, himself and Sarah Jane are escaping through the jungle from the Morestran spaceship, and they launch the Oculoid Tracker, which is clearly a drone.
Oh, yeah.
Which weren't invented for another 20 years or 25 years, but there it was on Doctor Who before it ever happened.
Amazing.
Who knows what will, you know, show up in the future. Maybe we will have giant robots that clear up our dead bodies.
Oh yeah, those are going to be super necessary in the future.
Oh boy. That's sad. Speaking of the cleaners, what they look at when they're taking a break is they look at the wall scrawls that are clearly like they're pictures of these cleaners attacking people. And then one of the cleaners actually shows up and the doctor is admiring it. And then it gets close and gets very threatening and they all run away. On the making of the Ryder and Andrew Cartmell, we're both like, those things don't look threatening at all. So they agree with you, but they don't like that they don't look threatening.
Oh, no, I think that's better.
They're like, they're so slow and unmenacing.
I think it's much better to have like this cute, friendly robot pass through the scene and then all of a sudden there's a foot sticking out of it. Like that has a sense of rhythm to it.
And they shouldn't look threatening because they were originally designed to be cleaning robots. And unless you're really weird, you don't design your cleaning robots to look threatening.
I think maybe that they were less concerned with it looking threatening and more concerned with the fact that it moves so slowly.
As does everything in Doctor Who.
The only slower robot on this show is Chameleon.
He not so much moves as just falls over slowly.
Then back at the Rezzy's place, they're having a chat. Again, sort of talking about more backstory of like how all the in-between people went to a war or something. But then this guy breaks through the door and...
This is the best scene.
And he's like, are these old ladies annoying you? And Mel's like, no. And he's like, are you annoying these old ladies? And they're like, no.
Stop breaking down our door. Every time you do this, we have to go out and buy a new door and fix it. This guy is doing this all the time.
His name is Pex, and he is...
dumb as dirt and amazing.
Yeah.
That's another thing that the writers didn't care for was they were imagining like a big like Arnold Schwarzenegger type to play him, like a big beefy guy. And then the casting director was like, I'd rather have somebody who can act. So, and like everybody they tested that was like a big, beefy, strong guy, the acting wasn't too great. So they went with like someone who could act over someone who was gigantic. And I think that works fine because it like makes him feel like more of a blowhard sort of thing. Like he's clearly this scrawny little dude who's like, I am super strong and great and masculine and... but he's just kind of a dweeb.
Yeah, he's trying to hide his fear behind a facade of... Look at me, I'm a big hero.
I think they specifically said that they were trying to... He was basically a parody of, like, Rambo and the Terminator and a lot of other sort of, like, 80s action movie characters. So, he's basically Casey Jones from the Ninja Turtles.
He is basically Casey Jones. And Pex is such a good name.
I like Pex a lot. He's adorably stupid. He's a himbo.
He's a himbo.
But he offers to be Mel's protector, which she's like, I don't need one. But he's like, I'll be your guide since you don't know your way around this place. And she's wanting to get to the pool.
Mel's reaction to someone saying, I'll be your protector is so great too. Cause it's just incredulous. Like, no.
Gonna protect me from these clearly innocent old ladies.
Protect me from people breaking down doors.
Do you know what else is great about these old ladies? They're not super related to the plot. Like the fact that they are cannibals isn't like some great big conspiracy plot stuff. There's other stuff happening, and also these two old ladies happen to be cannibals.
I mean, I think it's partially that, like, probably resources are low or whatever, you know?
Yeah, but they do seem to be the only ones out of the Rezzies
that are cannibals.
Are cannibals.
Yeah. And also, they have plenty of
they have
tea.
Baked goods.
Yeah.
They have plenty of, well, not cake. I guess they're out of cake, maybe, and that's why they're just, like, insisting on calling all their baked goods cake, because they ran out.
I don't know.
They're just, I want to know what happened that they have only tea snacks and apparently no meat.
I think you will find it's called Brexit.
Oh, shit, you're right. Fair enough.
people are going to hate me for that.
There are rats, though. Could they not eat rats?
This is what I'm saying. These people just enjoy eating people.
Some people are just like that. You know? It's good that those two found each other.
I think they do eat a rat because in a later episode, after Mel has got away, you see them finishing a meal and there's something, a very small set of bones on a plate. And they're saying, that was very nice, but it was very small. And I kind of took that to be a rat.
Oh. See, my mind was like, that's a child. Maybe not. There are no children, though. So.
Well, they're the Kangs, and they have said that, like, I guess they've eaten enough Kangs that, like, the Kangs won't hang out with them anymore.
Yeah. Speaking of the Kangs, Mel and Pex come across the Blue Kangs doing a big sort of funeral ritual thing for the Unalive Yellow. All hail the Unalive Yellow. She was, like, she's still a Kang. If she may not have been, like, a Blue Kang, but she was very brave nonetheless or whatever.
She was brave, like a Kang should be.
Yeah,
and you know what? If I can get on my soapbox and just talk about how good this is, because you know in sci-fi series, when you come to a planet or a place and it's either completely ruled by women or one of the teams on the planet is all women, they all tend to be really one-dimensional. And it's they're all women and they're all fierce, or they're all women and XYZ is happening to them. Whereas with the Kangs, you see them being raucous, you see them having fun, you see them being brave, you see them being sad and mourning other Kangs. It's like human females have more than one dimension to their emotions. It's really mind-bogglingly, you know, wild. Well, for 1970s, 1980s BBC, it actually is huge progress. And again, like the Rezzies, there's good women and bad women. They're not all exactly the same.
Some of them are just cannibals.
And some of them are just nice old ladies.
Yeah, but even with the Kangs, like, you have individual Kangs who are sometimes sad and sometimes brave and sometimes funny. And that's even better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I also really like this scene because it becomes very clear here that it is a game. So they're mourning the yellow Kang, the unalive. And they're like, did you make the yellow Kang unalive? And they are like mortified at this idea. You know, Kangs don't kill people. And so it does become very clear that this is a game that has become like a culture.
Killing them is not part of the game.
Yeah.
That is something else that has happened.
And that is also an interesting thing. I mean, because, like, the having, like, you know, warring tribes or whatever is also a sci-fi trope. And so to have that be like, well, it's a play on, like, what you expect you already know.
Yeah, and the other great thing that happens later, so, again, spoilers, but when the Blue Kangs finally win, you find out that, like, winning the game isn't we invade your headquarters and steal all your stuff and kill you. It's just we invade your headquarters and say, now you have to admit we won. That's all it is. And that's great because, you know, it again shows the gaminess of it.
It also kind of shows that it is kind of just, it is a little bit silly what they're all like, yeah, sort of fighting over. And that they, when they do team up, it's like, yeah, we can put aside all of this nonsense and do what needs to be done. Also, speaking of, like, unalive, they do a lot of things. Like, that's another thing, like, with this language. They don't say the thing, they'll say whatever the opposite is. Like, I enjoy that, too. There's, like, just the language
in
this
is so good.
It seems
like there are rules.
Yeah. I'm a fan of this one. This is a very good serial. It's the first serial in a very long time where I was just 100% on board with no reservations. But the last thing that happens in this episode is the doctor finally meets the chief caretaker. And the chief caretaker thinks that he is the great architect come to fix things. And because of that, the doctor's like, well, what does that mean? And he's like, well, kill him. So they're going to kill the doctor. And that is the end of episode one. And we are now into episode two, which I have called Brought to You by Fizz Aid.
I've gone for a music-based pun for this one. Kangs that make you go,
I had a music one for episode three. I changed it, but I'll mention it when we get there. So the doctor's execution is postponed because the chief caretaker has to go investigate 345, stroke 1-2, subsection 3's mysterious disappearance. Because it's very important we figure out what happened to that wonderful character.
What's in the rules?
Yeah, it's
he
in the rules.
He has to go investigate.
What's more than the rules? It's what's in our heart. We need to know what happened to Caretaker 345, stroke 1-2, subsection 3, Tony. So he heads out, and then the doctor just sort of hangs out with the rest of the caretakers, the chief deputy and whatnot. Meanwhile, Pex is just showing off for no reason and bends a light to just show how strong he is.
Mel's reaction to this is like, that's great, now put it back.
You know, it'd be better to be able to see.
It may be that Paradise Towers is not dystopian. All the damage you see in Paradise Towers may have been done by Pex. Just
showing off.
Just all the doors have holes in them. Bin Liner tells Fire Escape that no exit has been taken to the cleaners, which is just the most wonderful sentence.
Beautiful.
I love this stupid cereal. I'm not even going to further explain that. You get it. Then the doctor sort of hanging out with the caretakers and sort of just starts questioning the world building, specifically why the cleaners are killing and why would the caretakers want to kill him? If he's the architect, wouldn't they want him to fix stuff? And they're all like, no, it's just how things work. It's the rules. And he's like, well, can I see the rule book? And they're like, they flip through it and they're like, you can do it as a last request. And he's like, cool. And the rule book is actually, this is something else that the writer and Andrew Cartmell did not enjoy, and
but
I kind of agree with him.
Quite it's small.
It's very small. The type must be very, very tiny. I think it should be a great big thick book of just nonsense, you know? But then he does a great, I love this scene so much, where he's just like, oh, it says here that when you have
you have to close your eyes and count to 10.
Yeah, you have to get up and walk away and close your eyes and let me steal your keys so I can get out of here. And they're like, wait, what? He said, I said steal your keys so I can get out of here.
Well, if it's in the rule book.
You know what I would really love? I would really love if he picked up the book, which has on the front of it written the rules, and he starts reading it. And the first one is, you don't accept a date for a Saturday night if he calls you after Wednesday.
The first rule of the rule book is that there are no rules. The second rule is don't talk about Fight Club.
What's Fight Club?
I can't tell you. What other rules are in the rule book? Do you know?
No, but I don't follow rules.
No, white after Labor Day? So,
right before E, except after C.
So Peck says he was sent here by an unnamed group of people to protect these people, which we'll later find out is a lie. But right now, that's the story he's sticking by. And they are followed by Blue Kangs. The doctor takes some notes. He's like looking at the graffiti and he takes some notes and gets chased by cleaners. And then that's when the chief caretaker is informed that the doctor has escaped. So he wants to get him back. It's a lot of running around in this serial. Then we meet another Resi, Maddie, who drops by Tilda and Tabby's to tell them that a caretaker has gone missing. Our beloved 345/12, subsection 3. And that's when we first see that not all Resis are cannibals. Because that is an assumption you could possibly make.
There's something interesting about this scene that I thought was going to be a thing that turned out not to be a thing, which is that one of them is dressed in red, one of them is dressed in blue, and one of them is dressed in yellow. And I was like, oh, what does that mean? It didn't mean anything.
Just their style. So the doctor finds one of those phones and tries to make a call on it, but it doesn't work. So he hits it, and then coins start pouring out of it, and he catches them in his hat.
He says, jackpot.
He reads the coin, and it says that it's by the order of the great Cro-Agnon. We'll find out later that Cro-Agnon is the great architect. That is who the doctor is supposed to be. I'm not sure why he thought the doctor was the great architect.
I think it's just because nobody had been there in so long.
If anyone was to show up,
it would be the architect who knows about the place and would probably could figure out a way to get there.
So the doctor has got the coins, but then some cleaners show up and he falls through a door to get away from him. And that is, he falls into the Red Kang's brain quarters and then has a chat with him.
Brain quarters is fantastic.
All of the terms and terminology in this is so good. They sort of show him how the phones work. And he also says, this isn't just a phone. And he turns it around and it's a fizz aid dispenser, hence my title. And he puts some of the coins in it and a soda comes out and he drinks it and everybody drinks it. How old is that soda? It's got to be flat and bad by now, right?
You would think.
Maybe it's future soda and future soda
just doesn't have an expiration date.
Yeah, they've got some preservative thing going on. I mean, how long do sodas normally last?
About a year, I think. If they're in a can.
Well, then this definitely has to be some sort of future soda. I don't think that they've been in there for more than a year.
Yeah, because I think they were all kids and now they're all supposed to be teenagers, right? Is that the timeline of the serial?
I don't know what the timeline of the serial is, to be honest.
I couldn't tell if the Kangs were supposed to be younger than they were or if they were just young because they had grown up Lord of the Flies style. I'm not sure how much time is supposed to have passed.
It's kind of odd because whenever they ask anyone, when you ask the residents, it's like they've been there forever. It sounds like it's 20, 30 years, but then it can't be because the Kangs are only older teenagers or middle teenagers, so it can't really be more than 10 to 12 years.
If it's going by, because this serial is somewhat based on a novel called High Rise by J.G. Ballard, and I haven't read it, but from what I've read about it, it is like this high-rise building everybody sort of sealed off in and lives in, and it's self-sustaining. But that, like, time sort of, like, loses all meaning because it's just they exist in there, and the outside world is kind of just, they don't even think about it. So, like, and then it basically devolves into, like, these horrible societies of people just being awful and stuff, and it just becomes this whole thing. But, like, if it's going by that logic, it could just be, like, they've been locked off in this, that, like, time has no meaning anymore.
So it's only been, like, 10 years, but it might as well be forever.
Yeah. Fun fact, High Rise was made into a movie starring Tom Hiddleston and directed by... I forget who it is, but he directed New Who. He's directed some New Who episodes.
There was earlier this year, which we saw over in this side of the pond, and I guess you guys probably haven't, an absolutely brilliant, brilliant series called Hausen, which is the German... for house. So made in Germany, set in a Paradise Towers style high-rise block, but sort of in the present day, but really exactly like Paradise Towers in that it's peopled by dysfunctional residents and teenage gangs roaming around and something malevolent in the basement, which is causing all sorts of weird things to happen to people and goo dripping everywhere and people being grabbed by hands that come out of walls and smothered in goo or burned alive and all sorts of stuff. It's really amazing. I'll send you, you can't get it online anywhere, but there's a great trailer for it on YouTube. I'll send you the link for that.
Awesome.
I have seen the High Rise movie. I honestly wouldn't recommend it. It wasn't very good. But it's Ben Wheatley. He directed Into the Dalek and Deep Breath, which are two pretty good episodes. So a lot of Doctor Who connections here. Yeah, I'm a big fan of like sort of any Doctor Who episode or horror sci-fi thing that's like seals itself off in like one location that both feels huge but also very confining. I really like that. It's like this tower is huge, but it also feels very claustrophobic. That's a nice balance.
Like Ark in Space, you know, again, very confined on the Ark, but the Ark was actually quite big and lots of corridors to roam around in different areas. It actually also brings me to another thing I wanted to mention about Paradise Towers. I find so many times that the second story of a new Doctor is often way better than the first story. That's certainly the case with William Hartnell. Okay, it's not the case with Patrick Troughton. But if you look at Tom Baker, Robot was kind of okay, but Ark in Space was brilliant. Peter Davison, Castrovalva was a mess, but Forward to Doomsday was better. And again, with Matt Smith, you know, his first episode was too much concentrating on trying to get him together with Amy Pond. But the second episode, which was also a sort of Ark in Space, was again better and more exciting. And certainly, you know, Time in the Ranny, I don't know what your opinion of it is, because that episode has not been released on podcast yet. But I was underwhelmed when I watched it, but I was really much happier with Paradise Towers.
We liked Time in the Ranny, but this is definitely better.
Yeah, I think our, what do we say? We like Time in the Ranny, but it might just be because we're coming out of six.
Of that, yeah, last season, which was a huge mess.
Well, I can tell you, this Paradise Towers is the start of things getting better after a kind of a weaker period. You're going to start having more fun watching the serials that come out after this.
I'm so excited.
I missed fun.
And I feel like a lot of that's probably Andrew Cartmell, because Andrew Cartmell wasn't really that involved with Time in the Ranny, and this was the first one that he really had full hooks in. So, because Andrew Cartmell has hooks for hands. I know he doesn't. I don't know why I said that. I was trying to make a joke, but it was just really weird.
It was just bizarre.
Let's go back to the story and ignore weird things I say.
Yeah.
So Daddy talks to his hungry boy who's been eating more than he should.
Are you trying to be less awkward?
Okay, let me explain that. The chief caretaker goes to the basement. There's a big no-entry door that opens up, and we see this smoky room and a robotic voice who just keeps going, "Hungry! Hungry!" The chief caretaker refers to himself as Daddy. He's like, I've been feeding you. Why are you eating more people than I have sent down here? You've been eating people that I have not approved of. The only response he gets is, hungry, hungry. So the chief caretaker is bad and is feeding the basement. Then we find out that Pex and Mel have been captured by the Blue Kangs. And we learn that he is a muscle brain scaredy cat draft dodger, basically. He was supposed to go off to the war, but hit out and didn't go. And everyone thinks he's a huge coward because of it. But honestly, that'd probably be me. I wouldn't want to go to war. Have you seen wars? They're bad. But they let Mel leave to go do whatever she's doing because they're like...
Yeah, Mel's kind of like, I get why you think Pex is shitty. I get that. I got nothing to do with all this, though. So can I leave? And the Kangs are like...
He's not actually with me.
Yeah, I've got... What? I got nothing to do with any of this. And the Kangs are like, yeah, okay.
So she goes back to try to find the doctor or the pool, but winds up back at Tabby and Tilda's to have some more tea. Because they're like, come on, we'll give you some more tea. And she's like, fine, I'm so tired. The caretakers find the Red King's brain quarters and start burning through the door. The Red Kangs think that the doctor led them there, and they sort of turn against the doctor. And then back at Tabby and Tilda's, they throw a tiny net on Mel and come at her with a toasting fork.
I know. How terrifying must it be to be restrained by a small piece of wool?
They also come at her with the toasting fork, which like they were toasting the cookies with or whatever. And like that's what it was supposed to be through the whole serial. Anytime that they threatened Mel with a weapon, it was supposed to be that because the writer and Andrew Cartmell were both like, that is kind of goofy, so we can get away with it. And then they changed it in the next episode. One of them comes at her with a knife. And they were like, why did you do that? We're going to get so many complaints. And they did indeed get complaints. And Andrew Cartmell was like, they should have just listened to us to begin with. But that is the end of episode 2, is the tiny net. And we are now into episode 3, which I have called Home of the Unalive. I was going to call it Supper's Ready.
I've got another music-based pun for this, which is really scraping the bottom of the barrel, and yet is also quite brilliant. So this episode is Ice Hot the Sheriff.
Oh,
God.
Wow.
Oh, that's good. That's better than mine.
Wow.
Tony, is that a good wow or a bad wow?
Yeah.
I'm reading between the lines on that one.
Mine was a music reference too, but that was better. Ice Hot the Sheriff. That's amazing.
Bear in mind the next lyric is, but I didn't shoot the deputy, and he didn't.
Oh, the chief deputy. I'm going to need you to please convert the entire song and make it about Paradise Towers.
I'll see what I can do.
So what happens? So the doctor's like, I'm not with the caretakers. I didn't lead them here. In fact, I'm going to hold them off while you guys escape. And they're like, oh, cool. So the Red Kangs all leave while the doctor sticks around to kind of keep them off of the Red Kangs trail. Meanwhile, back at Tabby and Tilda's, Tabby is pulled through the waste disposal system. There's just like a big triangular flap on the wall, and like a robotic hand comes out and grabs her around the neck, pulls her to the hole. We cut away. We cut back and she's gone. Because there's no way they could have dragged that woman through that hole. I feel like the hole was smaller than she was. Which makes my mind think horrible thoughts. Like horrible, terrifying, horrific things. Basically.
Ew.
Then Tilda comes for Mel with the knife. But Pex busts through the door again in what looks to be the exact same shot, by the way. It looks like reused footage. And she throws the knife at him, which misses and embeds in the wall, and she goes to get another one, and Pex is just standing there doing absolutely nothing. Tilda gets grabbed by the hand and pulled through the waste disposal system as well, and then Pex is like, oh, looks like I saved you, Mel.
You're welcome.
Then they find a map in that apartment that should help them find the pool in the sky, as it is called. It also says at the bottom, basically, don't go in the basement. It's off limits. And then the doctor is brought to the chief again by the deputy. And the deputy is starting to question all of this. Like, a bunch of people are disappearing. What's up with this? Including our people and Something seems up. He's starting to question it a bit. But the chief starts interrogating the doctor, and the doctor is sort of on to him. He's like, I think you're ordering the murders, but I think there are more murders than the ones you're ordering. He puts all this together, and he's like, I think it's gotten out of your control. And that is somewhat confirmed when the deputy comes in and tells him that two of the Rezzies, Tabby and Tilda, are missing, and that the chief caretaker has to go investigate that, because them's the rules. I'm less concerned about this than I am about, his investigating the disappearance of caretaker.
You don't have it anywhere near you where you're looking at the
345/1-2 subsection 3. I know it in my head. I didn't go look it up. So he leaves to go investigate that. Mel and Pex try to take the elevator to the pool, but the elevators don't work because apparently the Kangs have pressed all the buttons.
Which is, again, amazing.
That's a very childlike thing to do.
And it's exactly the sort of thing that happens in those high-rise blocks all the time. I worked as an IT technician for a few years in a college in London, which had, I think it was 16 floors. And any time you got in the elevator, some student had already pressed every single button just to make sure that your journey was as slow as it possibly could be. I would note, by the way, that brave, independent Mel, who doesn't need a guide, has taken until episode 3 to realize that in order to get to the pool in the sky on the top floor, she might want to think about going up in the lift.
That is a good point. Sometimes the most obvious answer just seems right out of your grasp, you know?
I used to, when I was leaving work, when we worked on the fifth floor, I would hit all the buttons on the way out. But I was the last person to leave. So I wasn't doing it to anyone.
You're doing it to the elevator.
Yeah, I don't know. It satisfied something in my brain.
Think of the energy usage. You were single-handedly driving climate change.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
But on the plus side, you were ringing up a bill for, the boss.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the doctor is sort of just chilling out in the caretaker's place, watching a video brochure about Paradise Towers. Honestly, this video makes it look like it might be on Earth, possibly in the future. It looks like just a normal video. And they have said on the documentary, like, we don't really say where it is. Maybe it is Earth. I'm looking forward to getting some phys aid in the future that lasts forever.
That lasts for at least a decade.
But while he's watching this, the Red Kings sort of tap him on the shoulder, and he's like, I'm watching something. Oh, hey! And then he walks over, and all of the caretakers have been tied up by the Red Kangs, and then he runs off with the Red Kangs. But the doctor gets the video brochure before he leaves, which is on a CD?
It's on a DVD.
Yeah, when did, CDs and DVDs first become, available? I don't even know.
Well, CDs were kind of mainstream from fairly early in the 80s. DVDs... Well, there were these laser disc things before DVDs. And I think they may have been late 80s, so it makes sense.
But like a disc like that with video on it, would that be something that was possible?
I think laser discs, you could have a video on the laser disc. Were late 80s? I am Googling it as we speak.
Do our research.
So laser disc is a home video format. And the first commercial optical disc storage, first licensed in the United States in 1978.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's earlier than I thought. I have no idea how time works.
So it's definitely a laser disc. Why did we move from laser disc to DVD?
Right.
Just not as good. I mean, eventually we got to Blu-ray.
Yeah,
which Blu-ray is a little
kind of cool.
Ray is definitely as cool, at least, as laser.
But now, physical media is just not as popular anymore. That's a bummer.
We don't have time for me to get on my soapbox about this, but y'all need to own things.
So to answer your question, having scrolled a little bit further down the article, first of all, the laser disc was kind of a hybrid child in that it was storing the information digitally on a disc, but the information was analog. So it was kind of converting analog to digital to store it and then reconverting it to analog.
Huh.
And the quality wasn't anywhere near as good as a DVD, apparently. And also it couldn't hold as much.
Were laser discs the big record looking things, or was that something else?
I couldn't answer that one.
I think You're right. I think laser discs are big.
I think so, too. I feel like I've seen a few, like in secondhand stores and stuff like that. Yeah, yes. They're large. They're, like, record-sized. So whatever the doctor's holding is, like, CD size.
So it's probably mildly future-y.
Yeah, mildly future-y. The chief is investigating the disappearance of the two Rezzies, and Maddie comes in. She's there with him and sort of like freaking out about all this. And he convinces her to not say anything by bribing her with this larger apartment, which I wouldn't want to live in. There's a murder bot in the wall.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And to be fair, she doesn't fully, I mean, she agrees to it to his face, but she continues to be worried and she takes some matters into her own hands later. So Mel worries, there's a scene where Mel is worrying about stuff in the elevator. She's like, what if we stop between floors? And then it stops between floors. And she's like, oh, at least the lights haven't gone out. And then the lights go out. And then they basically just crash into the basement. Classic comedy scene. I thought they were just going to like, oh, we crash in the basement. We're going to go find stuff in the basement. But they leave there pretty quickly. They don't actually do anything while they're in the basement, which seems like a bit of a missed opportunity, but gotta pad out the episode sometimes. So the Doctor and the Red Kangs finish watching the video, which says that Cro-Agnon also designed this place called Miracle City and killed everyone who moved in. Well, the video doesn't say this. The Doctor is like, oh, I know this. He killed everyone who moved into Miracle City because he's like, this place is too good for people, but he kind of got away with it. And then went on to make Paradise Towers. The Doctor theorizes that he was trapped inside of it before he could finish it. So, like, they were like, we love his work, but we know he's going to turn murderous. So we'll just trap him inside before he's done. This makes sense.
I mean, truly it does. How many people have been like, oh, well, they're a horrible person, but they are a genius. So we do have to work with them, even though he has murdered a bunch of people before. I have a plan. It's fine.
It happens all the time in business.
Yeah.
That's true. Or like, oh, he's a horrible person, but he makes good TV. Let him have another season.
I know so many talented people who don't suck. I could give you some numbers. I could put you in contact with some people.
Yeah, me too. There's Tony B. Heath. There's Joey. Steve Conway. So, Pex kicks the elevator into working again. The Doctor and the Red Kangs are going to go to the basement because the Doctor figures that's where stuff is happening. But they are interrupted by the Blue Kangs, who enter and say, we won.
We won the game.
We won. The Doctor's like, that doesn't matter. We gotta, you know, there's more important things to solve here. And then sort of they agree to go with them. So it's Red Kangs and Blue Kangs are... And the Doctor are all going to go to the basement and find out who's killing all these people, basically. Whereas, meanwhile, Mel and Pex finally find the pool. Pex is very nervous about it because he says this is the home for the unalive. And Mel's like, I don't care. I've been wanting to swim for 3 episodes now. I am going to swim. But what she doesn't know is that there is a cleaner in the pool. Not like one of the great big cleaners, but it's a tiny little yellow.
Also very cute.
Lobster crab looking robot. It's
that great. Robot looks like a robot that they got to use that already existed.
I don't think so. I think they made it.
It looks much too nice.
I was originally going to be like a tentacle monster thing. And then I believe J&T is like, Doctor Who has not had the best history with tentacle monsters. So maybe. And it honestly makes more sense for it to be a robot. Cleaner. Cause...
Yeah. Think how excited that robot must have been, because we've established that nobody ever goes up there. So it's been cruising around the pool for year after year, waiting to eat somebody. And no one ever comes near it. And all of a sudden... fresh blood.
Aw. But sweet. It's going to get deprived of its meal. It's very sad. There's so many people just being deprived of meals in this. Those old ladies don't get to eat mail. This robot doesn't get to eat mail. Is anybody going to get to eat mail?
That's a question that won't be answered on this podcast.
Lastly, in this episode, the hungry boy in the basement reveals himself to be Cro-Agnon, and he wants a body, and he has the cleaner shove the chief caretaker into this room that we've been hearing the voice from, and a thing falls down around him. Basically, he's going to take the chief's body. The Doctor and the Kangs watch this from a distance, but then as they're leaving, the cleaners turn on them, and one of the cleaners grabs the doctor by the throat. And that is the end of episode 3. And we are now into episode 4, which I have called Build High for Happiness.
And I have called Kang Bang.
See, you said that mine were going to look great in comparison to yours. You're a liar. Mine are awful. Yours are so good.
What can I say? I lie. I also really wanted to use at one point Kangs of New York, but it's not in New York. So
now my brain's just trying to think of Kang puns.
See, my whole thing was thinking about Kangs are from the Ninja Turtles.
Krang.
Yeah.
Citizen Kang.
Citizen Kang.
Yeah.
Citizen Kang. Yeah. That's my title for this one. I got nothing. Okay, so the chief caretaker is now Cro-Agnon. He's like very zombie-ish and I believe there were some people on set that J&T, I think, was like, what is he doing? This is too cheesy. This is too bad. This is too much. Even the actor playing him heard this from him and he's like, I'm just going to do it more. So
respect.
Like, I know what I'm doing. He's lost his mind. Of course he's going to be over. How do you play this if you're not going to play it over the top? You want me to play this subtly? He's Hitler zombie. And I agree. I think this is great. I love what he's doing here.
I kind of weave back and forward on this one. It was an example of stunt casting, of which J&T was becoming a very, very regular performer on this, because he had been one of the most famous sitcom actors in Britain and much beloved for comedy. And that's the reason why in episode 1, the first few times we see the chief caretaker, you're only seeing his arm or you're seeing something else. And they're kind of holding him back to do the big reveal of, look what famous person we got to be in the episode this time. But yeah, look, listening to it from your point of view, and that's, as I said, one of the things I've loved about the podcast is I'm seeing my childhood television through fresh pairs of eyes. And if you find it really fun, that makes me rethink.
Also, like, we're American and
yeah, I got no idea who that dude is.
Yeah, so we're like young and American, so that's like a double whammy for why I have no idea who this guy is. What was the sitcom that he was popular for?
It was called The Good Life. It was on in the mid-70s. Basically, suburban couple decide to drop out of the rat race, leave their jobs, grow vegetables and rear pigs in their suburban back garden. And it was really good. It was very, very funny. And he became really well known for that. The interesting thing is that after Paradise Towers, he was in another sitcom called Ever Decreasing Circles, in which he plays the kind of organizer for a local residence committee / neighborhood watch, who is absolutely rules obsessed. So his next sitcom character drew a little bit from Paradise Towers.
I was trying to think, like, if this was like made now with my sort of cultural context, American and my age group or whatever. Like, it'd have to be like, I don't know, my brain just like, I'm now imagining this guy being played by Ted Danson, and I think that'd be pretty good.
Yeah, or you look at it and it's Matt LeBlanc or someone. It's that he was that kind of level of well known in the UK.
So that's less interesting than to me. Ugh. I could see that. Maybe
now that's put in context, you're like,
maybe it could be the other guy. What's his name?
Matthew someone.
Perry. Matthew Perry.
Yeah, that's it.
There
yeah.
you go.
That would honestly be wild.
That's what it was like for us.
Oh, could you imagine David Schwimmer, Ross?
Oh. Yeah, that would be wild, like trying to take Ross seriously.
as a Hitler zombie.
Yeah.
Perfect. Stupid. Okay, so Mel goes for a swim. And she is attacked by the pool cleaner. Pex just stands there doing nothing. So she grabs his gun out of his holster and shoots the robot. And we get a really cool effect of like its POV as it sinks and everything gets like very digitally and special effecty. And I really like that shot. It's good. But there's no more swimming from here on out. And that's a little sad. Why wouldn't she go back in? The robot's dead.
I think it's kind of spoiled it.
I guess. I almost called this episode Regulation ZZZ because the deputy enacts that regulation, which just calls everybody back to headquarters because he's freaking out.
Because
No,
Only the Kangs have brain
quarters?
Only
the Kangs have brain quarters.
Okay.
But the, call everybody back to the office while, because he's freaking out because the chief caretaker, or Crow-Agnon, is now just going around, just gassing everyone. The cleaners are, like, emitting this gas that kills people. Why did they never do that before? I always had to use the little, the big screw and the clamper hand.
Why are you asking me questions I don't have answers to?
Perhaps because before they still had to be somewhat clandestine in the way they operated, whereas now it's no holds barred.
Yeah, they were looking for a body and now they found one.
Why did it take them so long to find the body? Because it's this guy that's been helping him this whole time.
Sentimentality, maybe?
Or maybe he's been feeding and now he's eaten enough that he can take over a body. Has he been eating the body? What has he been doing with the bodies? I'm suddenly questioning everything about this serial.
It's interesting as well, because usually when you get one of those stories and it's, I'm looking for the perfect body, it's always going to be the doctor, because they want to possess the doctor or eat the doctor. So it's refreshing to see that it's actually somebody else they wanted to take over.
The stunt casting guy. The doctor and the Kangs find Melonplex up on the, I guess it's the roof, I'm not sure. The Kangs proceed to tease Pex, again calling him a coward, and he's about to leave. But as he's leaving, because he's like, oh, everybody's making fun of me, he bumps into Maddie and some other Rezzies who do not talk because they're probably...
Because they did not get paid.
Yeah, you have to pay them more if they talk. But they bump into Maddie and some Rezzies who have come to ask for help. Then the chief makes it to the office and orders the deputy to... quote, get rid of all the flesh. But the deputy is like, that's not good, and just runs out of there, terrified. And then back on the roof, the Kangs agree to work with the Rezzies, and they agree to work with Pex. But they say, we will not work with the caretakers. And then the deputy...
No cops at Pride.
No cops at Pride. Then the deputy pops his head in and is like, hey, I just wanted to say, can I work with you guys? It's very good. Basically, they just, like, everybody just starts agreeing to help each other. And it's actually kind of nice. It's a little cheesy, but I don't know. I liked it. I like how enthusiastic everyone starts to get here. They're all like, yeah, let's do it. Let's send the cleaners to the cleaners. Which apparently that was said by Fire Escape. And she's like, I hated the way I said that line.
Aww.
She's like, I'm very glad that I'm not on screen when I say it, because I can claim that it's not me. But then she said that in a documentary, so now everyone knows she's the one who said, send the cleaners to the cleaners. They start coming up with plans. The deputy's like, there's some stuff that we use to take out the rats that's in a storage closet. It's explosives?
You know how sometimes you just explode rats?
Yeah, all the time. All the time exploding rats. And the Rezzies are like... we have tablecloths that we can use to slow down the cleaners so that the Kangs can shoot them with their bows and arrows. We're all working together. We will see that happen. The Rezzies and the Kangs destroy a cleaner. The Rezzies throw this tablecloth over them and they're blinded. But it's very see-through.
It's like, it is...
it's just like a doily or something. Yeah. It seems very old school, like how they used to defeat the Daleks. Just throw some mud in its eye. It'll be fine.
Yeah, and of course, the cleaners don't have a voice, but inside they're going, my vision is impaired. I cannot see.
But their last sort of plan is the doctor says we need to lure Crow-Agnon into a trap. He says, I will be the bait, but someone else has to go get him. Because like, I'll just be like, you're very dumb and I'm very smart, and that'll cause him to come out. And Pex offers to be the one to lead Crow-Agnon into the trap. He will be a hero for once.
Would you trust him? Would you really trust him?
Honestly, I would, because I'm a sucker. The whole time they were like, you know, calling him Cowardly Cutlet and Scaredy Cat. I was just like, be nice to him. I get very uncomfortable when people are like, you know.
Mean,
yeah. So I would definitely be like, he can do a thing. Just give him a chance. But they do agree to give him a chance. And he gets a bracelet from the Kangs to symbolize that he's, you know, as brave as a Kang or whatever. He also gets some dynamite. Then he gives Mel his gun because he's like, I'm not going to need it. And it was at that point that I was like, oh, he's going to die. He's straight up going to die. And spoilers, was not wrong.
Poor himbo.
He's also been told that, like, get Cryogonon out of his office as soon as you can so he can't look at the monitors, see what we're doing. Get him out very quick. But once you get him out, take your time getting him to us so that we can finish setting up the trap, because we're going to need as much time as we can. So Pex goes and tells Cryogonon that he can take him to the doctor. And then they're walking. The chief caretaker is being very creepy, and Pex panics and is like, let's get there right now. Let's go. Let's go. Let's hurry this up. So he does the thing he's not supposed to do. So when he gets there, they're not quite ready for him. And the doctor tries to shove Cryogonon into the trap, which is through this. Basically, they've set up an explosive area in a room, and they're going to shove him in it, and it'll explode, I guess. But he can't shove him in because Cryogonon's too strong at this point. And Pex tries to run away, but keeps getting blocked, and then sort of was like, I've got to do the right thing. And he goes and he grabs, like, the doctor's being throttled by the chief. And Pex grabs the doctor and chucks him aside. Like, throws him into a wall.
Yeah, it seemed way harder than necessary.
And then he headbutts Cryogonon, and they both fall into the trap. And they both explode. And then we see the funeral ritual again. And everyone is hailing Pex this time. The doctor is given a red and blue Kang scarf. It's like blue on the outside, and you flip it inside out, and it's red. And they're like, you're an honorary Kang now. We still don't like you, Mel. No, they don't. They don't say that.
I want to see that scarf make an appearance in Yoo-Hoo. I want us to see it lying there in the TARDIS one day, this little red and blue scarf. Just, you know, corner of a shot, I'd be quite happy.
Doctor's like, these are my Kang colors.
Yeah.
My Kang colors.
Your Kang colors. So they head out. The doctor tips his hat to the pump again. And Mel again says, no, doctor. He says, well, you never can tell. Again, that's just Sylvester McCoy's joke. And it, like, perfectly bookends this serial. I think it's great. And then they get in the TARDIS, and the TARDIS disappears, revealing some wall scrawl. It's got the blue and red scarf of the Kang, and it has the it says Pex Lives in big letters. There's like a handful of Doctor Who serials that have like big graffiti moments.
Well, there's graffiti on the TARDIS, wasn't there?
Yeah,
and like makes them scrub it off.
Yeah, but there's like, it made me think of both like Bad Wolf, and it made me think of that the 12th Doctor one when Clara dies, and like that guy.
Are you air quoting? You air quoted Clara.
I meant to air quote dies, and I air quoted Clara. I meant to do dies with the air quotes. Like anybody, if this is an audio podcast, they can't even see me doing it.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to make sure everybody knew
how much of an idiot I am. Yeah. Right, but yeah, when like he does the little the sort of mural of Clara. All right. Anyway, that's the end of the serial. It's the end of Paradise Towers. That's the end of the serial. We're going to take a
shit.
We're going to take a shit. I didn't know that. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back for final thoughts.
Welcome to Dr. Geek's Laboratory.
Dr. Geek here with another reminder that the ESO Network is pro-science and pro-vaccine. We urge you to be a superhero and protect yourself, your family, and your fellow geeks around the world. Don't be fooled by the forces of evil and their anti-science misinformation campaign. Consult the latest CDC guidelines, your doctor, and get the COVID vaccine today.
Welcome to the Ring of Thunder, the most electrifying wrestling podcast in the Thunderverse and the ESO Network. From the power of the people's host, Sexy Thor, critics say, it doesn't matter what the critics say. You already know you're in for a hammer-swinging, burrito-eating, mic-blazing, hair-raising time with this weekly wrestling adventure. WWE, AEW, Impact, and whatever else I can possibly fit. If you hear what the Thunder is talking.
And we're back. Tony, do you know what bit we're about to do?
I sure do, Joe. I sure do.
A bit that's apparently a metaphor for our sex life. What bit are we about to do, Tony?
The one where you ask me what time it is.
Hey, what time is it?
Right now it is 7:59.
It's much later for
PM.
Our guest. What time is it for you?
1 minute to 1 a.m. in the morning.
See, you are keeping this man awake with your silly, silly bit.
Yeah.
So what do we do after we do the silly, silly bit?
We do the final thoughts.
Oh, yeah. It's time for final thoughts.
Final thoughts.
I really like this. I have to say, both now and in the past when I watched it originally, it was like a step up and it was a step back towards Doctor Who being a bit more fun and a bit more interesting. There was some stuff in it specifically that I found very interesting. I've always loved language and the whole kind of linguistic shift thing that was going on with, you know, corridors becoming carridors and the various other things. And I found that great fun. And then as well, the fact that you had possibly the best representation of women and girls that you'd had for a long, long time in the series. Not all the same, different emotions, even different emotions in the same people. Happy, sad, excited, fearful, tearful, and, you know, capable of growing and changing as well. I thought that was really, really good. And just, it gave me hope that things were going to get better, as indeed they did.
I really, really liked this one because it was fun. Because it was fun to watch. The gangs are cool. I like their little game. I like anytime where you have a story that's in kind of this like abandoned place that's been left to kind of mutate, I guess, the world as we know it, where it's something very familiar, but that's also like very clearly removed and it's had time to kind of change. I always find that really fascinating, and that's a really fun thing that I like to see played with. You know, things changing over a generation, or the language drift, like Steve said. Just like recognizable things that are being used in a different context is really fun for me. It's got a cute robot in it.
It's got more than one.
Yeah. Two cute killer robots. I think the Rezzies, who are cannibals, again, who like don't, it's not important that they're cannibals. They're not cannibals for like a plot reason. They are just two really funny cannibals that are in the serial. It's just an extra thing. Like, this serial's very clearly having fun. And, like, that is its main priority. Mm. And that hasn't been Doctor Who's priority in a minute. So, I'm looking forward to what comes after it.
I agree. I love this serial so much. It's fun. It's got so many clever things. Its world building is amazing. Red Kings are best. I enjoy so much about it. And I feel like it is sort of like going back to what we've done before. Having fun, telling a story. But it's also not, it's the first one we've had in a while that hasn't been a callback to something else. It's not, you can watch this without really knowing much about Doctor Who. It's like a standalone serial. And I feel like we haven't had one of those for a very long time. We've been very much like, the Daleks are back.
We've been very continuity heavy.
Yeah, Cybermen. And even like, oh, it's Syl's back or whatever. I mean, the whole last season was one big long continuous, you know, thing. Sort of like that. But so it's nice to sort of just get back to basics a little bit. And just tell a good story that's not necessarily super reliant on continuity or, honestly, nostalgia a little bit. It's just a good story told really well. And I just super enjoyed it. I thought it was so much fun. And it is so refreshing after I really enjoyed some stuff in the Sixth Doctor era, but I am well aware that it was very messy. This feels like the first time in a long time that it has been just
some thought put into it.
It's just really competent, you know? And it's been a while since this show has been really competent. Like, this is the best episode in a long time. Maybe since, I don't even know. Like,
what did we vote number one in the Sixth Doctor era?
I don't even remember. Is it Vengeance on Varos? I think it was Vengeance on Varos. Vengeance on Varos was really good.
I just know, by the way, that when you get to your Sweet 16 for the Sylvester McCoy era, Tony is going to say, yeah, I vaguely remember that, but I've no idea what happened in Paradise Terrace.
Oh, it's true.
Yeah, we're going to be doing
What's worse?
March or April, probably.
Is that, like, things really stick in my head, and so there'll be something about, like, a really bad episode that I, like, really liked, but the thing that I really like sticks in my head, so I'm like, that was a great one, right?
I'm like, no, that one thing was good and everything else was garbage.
And sometimes the opposite happens. Like, we were talking about enlightenment and I was like, enlightenment wasn't that good because I was thinking about the end. And then you were like, no, that was one with like the, and I was like, oh yeah, wait, I forgot about the beginning of it because the beginning of it's rad. So it's just one element of it, if any, sticks in my head and sticks out. And because I know this, I don't want to sit there at the end and be like, yeah, objectively, that one was very bad.
It's a good thing we do this, huh? You should just, like, re-listen to this podcast when we're done. And you'll be like, what am I talking about? I don't remember any of this.
I don't understand having any of these opinions. I actually, my sister sent me, this is very bad, but my sister sent me the other day vlogs of mine that she had found.
Oof.
And I had some opinions.
Oof.
And she sent it to me and she was like, I did not know that you had made stuff like this. And I was like, I don't remember ever being that angry in my life. But I'm so angry in those vlogs. I don't even know like what I'm talking about. I'm just watching them and I'm like, I don't know who that is.
That's why you don't listen to your old stuff or else you find out you made some joke about your sex life. So that's it for Paradise Towers. Before we go, is there anything you would like to plug?
Well, I read a really good book recently called Road Trippy.
God, I forgot. Yeah.
I would plug that to anyone who's into kind of, I wouldn't call it science fiction, but, you know, who's into fun kind of, I don't know, verging on science fiction kind of stuff. Really, really nice. It reminded me to a certain extent of Douglas Adams. There was just kind of what Douglas Adams might be like if he was writing about the modern world. It was great fun. I haven't actually finished it yet. I'm only halfway through because I mostly read digitally these days. I have very little time for physical books, but it is really kind of good. The connection, the Douglas Adams connection, is kind of strengthened for me because if you've ever read or heard as an audiobook the part of The Salmon of Doubt that was kind of published, the last piece of Douglas Adams that we get is Dirk Gently driving through the desert and heading for this mysterious client, and Road Trippy starts with someone driving through the desert, and it's almost like there's this kind of continuum between them.
Man, I wish that was on purpose.
Yeah, but when you try and do it on purpose, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
The best synchronicities are ones that just happen because the universe wants it.
You end up writing And Another Thing.
Oof. Yeah.
I mean, it is funny that you compare it to Douglas Adams, considering the three authors of that book all met on the Douglas Adams Continuum, a fan forum for Douglas Adams. So it's no surprise that it was heavily influenced by Douglas Adams. I would like to plug a book called Shiprocked, which I've read and is really good.
Yeah, I've read it and I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go on.
Are you getting more sleep?
Yes.
I was so concerned the whole time reading this book. Like, I'm calculating the hours of sleep that this man has gotten, and it is not enough.
It's funny, I say to people that one of my abiding memories of those years was lack of sleep.
And we're making you revisit that right this second.
Yes, but in a really nice way. No, look, I had some amazing adventures and it was a great time. And I just felt that the story needed to be told. The funny thing is, Paradise Towers was originally mentioned in that book, but my final draft was 166,000 words. And the publisher insisted that it be cut down to 90,000. Otherwise, they wouldn't publish it because they said they liked it, but they didn't want Lord of the Rings. So I had to cut and cut and cut and cut, and there was just this little piece in the autumn of 87, and the ship that we were on was kind of a bit like Paradise Towers. It was dystopian in the sense that everything was falling apart, and there were lots of kind of, you know, dimly lit corridors with rusting pieces of equipment lining them, and then things gradually disintegrating, even though it was a place where we had a tremendous amount of fun. And I watched Paradise Towers out on the ship in the autumn of 1987. And I watched it up at the top of the ship in the newsroom all on my own. It was this time of year and it was dark outside and the wind would be kind of whipping up and the waves would be there and the woodwork in the newsroom would be creaking And it just created the perfect atmosphere.
Amazing.
For watching Paradise Towers. And I said in the book, originally, one of my favorite TV programs was showing this serial called Paradise Towers, and that it was just so perfectly suited to the location I was in at the time. Do you know what? If I ever do a director's cut of the book, that sentence is going back in there.
I hope you do, and I will read that director's cut.
He will. He'll read them both at the same time to compare the differences.
I've done it with Stephen King's The Stand, so yeah. Release the Conway cut! get that trending on Twitter. Okay, so you plugged my book, I plugged your book. Is there anything else you wanna plug?
If you enjoy good music, I'm on a station called 8radio.com these days, which you will find, surprisingly enough, at 8radio.com. But other than that, no, there's nothing to plug.
Well, if you liked this episode of...
Wow.
What? Do you want to plug something?
No.
All right, cool. I will say also, check out The Dip. They're better than BuzzFeed.
Better than BuzzFeed.
TheDip.com, DIPP.
Do not get your employer in trouble with BuzzFeed.
The views I have are not representative of The Dip or whatever, but we all know The Dip's better. Yeah, check out the Comic Completist series. I just finished watching all of the comic book media that came out in the 1940s. Because I'm that kind of weirdo. But if you like this episode of the podcast, you can check out more on WatchYourAssalon.com. You can also find our podcast, our Patreon, our Amazon wish list, and more at linktree.com/watchathon. That's linktr.ee/watchathon. And I want to say special thanks again to Bisexual Brigadier for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, thanks, Bisexual Brigadier.
Check her out at bisexualbrigadier.tumblr.com. And I also want to give a special shout out to Vince and EL for providing us with our amazing theme song.
Thank you, Vince.
You can check out more of their music at soundcloud.com/VinceandEL or VinceandEL.bandcamp.com. And tune in next time when we talk about Delta and the Bannermen.
Bannermen?
Bannermen? I hope it's not about the Delta variant, because I'm tired of COVID. Until next time, keep calm and wrestle on.
Goodbye, and I love you in a platonic, parasocial way.
Goodbye.
Red Kangs, Red Kangs, Red Kangs are best!
So who's best?
The Red Kangs, I gather.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.